It is my great pleasure to introduce this morning's speaker. Randi Semple received her doctorate in clinical psychology from Columbia University. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at USC, where she teaches and provides clinical training and supervision to psychiatry residents and to graduate students. Her research and clinical interests are in the application of mindfulness to psychological health and well-being, the development and integration of mindfulness-based interventions in psychiatric clinics and in school settings. Her work in the area of mindfulness with youth has been at the forefront of growing international interest in mindfulness-based therapies in mental health care for the past decade. Dr. Semple is co-author of the book Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy for Anxious Children. This is a very recent book. The popular media have followed her work in radio and newspaper interviews. She's spoken at local, national, and international professional conferences. We are delighted to have Dr. Semple with us here today.
Good morning, and thank you for inviting me into this lovely space. My talk today is called Mindfulness. It's not what you think. Most religions advocate some sort of contemplative practices to promote spiritual growth and development. But in the past 40 to 50 years, in Western culture, there's emerged a secular contemplative practice that is becoming increasingly popular. So today I'm going to talk about one model of mindfulness. Mindfulness-based paradigms have given rise to a whole variety of training programs and more recently, mindfulness-based psychotherapies. A lot is research supported. The NIH has funded over 500 studies on mindfulness now. And it's being used to treat a wide variety of medical and psychiatric disorders. In general community use, it's helpful to develop social-emotional resiliency and deal with everyday stressors. Journeys are always easier to navigate when we have a roadmap, so I'll start just by giving you an overview of where we're going this morning. I'm going to start by defining mindfulness. And I saw in the program that tomorrow night there's actually meditation based on Jack Kornfield's work. So for those who are familiar with that, some of what I'm going to say may sound a little boring, but I hope not to bore you for too long. Then we're going to practice a mindfulness exercise together. I'll discuss the current thinking, theoretical modeling of mindfulness and how its effectiveness is attributed. And we'll talk about some benefits to practicing mindfulness because it's actually a simple but not easy practice. And then as by way of summary, I'll give you what I think are the most important take-home points. Let's start by defining mindfulness. In 1890, the great psychologist William James said, "The faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will." And he went on to write about the importance of attention. But then he noted, "But it's easier to define this ideal than to give practical directions for bringing it about." Contemporary mindfulness practices are exactly that. They're practical directions for bringing about a wandering attention, bringing back a wandering attention. So what is mindfulness? John Kabat-Zinn's definition is often quoted. He said, "Mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally." So note that the heart of mindfulness is attention, but it's a particular kind of attention. It has three qualities. It's intentional. There's a purpose to it. There's a conscious awareness of the act of bringing mindfulness to the present. It's focused on the here and now. It's not remembering. It's not contemplating. It's not anticipating the future. It's focused in the present moment. And it's non-judgmental of those present moment experiences. So mindfulness essentially is seeing clearly and accepting the reality of whatever our experiences happen to be, moment by moment by moment. Mindfulness brings awareness to what is, rather than what we think it should be. Shooting on ourselves and shooting on others creates unhappiness. That's S-H-O-U-L-D. For example, when we tell ourselves, I should be a better person, or I shouldn't have said that, it brings up anxiety, depression, self-negativity, reduces our own self-esteem, creates unhappiness. When we should on the world or other people, he shouldn't have cut in front of me on the freeway. Well, she should learn how to drive. It brings up anger and frustration and irritability with other people. Mindful awareness is seeing what is and not getting stuck in the suffering of living in the should-be's. Anybody think of their own examples? Now, you may be wondering how mindfulness relates to religion or spirituality. Mindfulness is not a spiritual practice, although many of the contemporary mindfulness programs have borrowed a lot of the meditative techniques from Buddhism. Buddhist psychology describes a perspective on the world that's very different than Western psychology and Western religions. Buddhism offers instructions on how to be happy in the world, very specific instructions. They're known as the Noble Eightfold Path, and these were the principal teachings of the Buddha. The Eightfold Path is intended to lead the practitioner towards self-awakening and liberation from suffering. But mindfulness is only one component of the Eightfold Path. Like Western psychology, though, Buddhism has always been concerned with thoughts and emotions. The Buddha identified both emotional and cognitive causes of suffering. The emotional cause is desire, or its opposite, aversion. We like, we want more of it, we want to hold on to it. We don't like, we want to push it away, we want it to stop. We spend our lives swimming in this sea of likes and dislikes. According to Buddhism, the cognitive cause of suffering is ignorance of the way things truly are. To practice mindfulness is to refine one's capacity for awareness of whatever occurs in each moment as it occurs. With mindful awareness, we practice looking and seeing how we create so much of our own suffering with judgments and emotional filters. I'm a psychological researcher, not a spiritual teacher. I don't teach Buddhist religious precepts, although I practice them. But I do adopt a mindfulness-based approach to my research and my clinical practice simply because it's often helpful. Now, experiences of mindful awareness are much more educational than anything I could ever talk about. So why don't we practice one mindfulness exercise now? This activity is called the 3-minute breathing space, and it's from a program I'll talk about a bit later, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And there's three steps. Step one is awareness. We start by forming the intention to be present fully in this moment. And we can do this by taking what I call a mindful posture, sitting up straight, uncrossing legs and arms, forming the clear intention that for the next 3 minutes I'm going to be present in this moment. If you're comfortable, you can close your eyes. start by bringing awareness to your present moment experiences by asking yourself, what is my experience right now? In my thoughts, in my feelings, in my body sensations. Not for the purpose of changing, but rather the purpose of acknowledging, registering what's present. I call it taking inventory. What am I thinking right now? What am I feeling? What is my emotional experience? What are my body sensations? Just acknowledging, registering what the experience of this moment is, even if it's uncomfortable or unwanted. When you're ready, I invite you to redirect your attention to your breathing, either following the breath at the belly, experiencing the rising of the belly as the breath goes in, and the falling of the belly as the breath goes out. Or you may prefer to follow your breathing at your nostrils, feeling the movement of air in and the air out. Just following each breath, one breath at a time. When you notice that your thoughts have carried you off, gently note where they went and then bring them back to your breathing. You may want to tell yourself, breathing in, I know that I'm breathing in. Breathing out, I know that I'm breathing out. Your breath can function as an anchor to keep you in this present moment, to help you tune into awareness and an internal stillness. Breathing in, breathing out. Begin to expand your field of awareness, keeping the breath at the center, until you can bring awareness to the body as a whole, becoming aware of your posture, your facial expression, the people around you, the room that you're in. The 3-minute breathing space provides a way of stepping out of the automatic pilot mode that we all live in and reconnecting with the present moment. Seem like a simple activity, and it is. Bringing awareness to the breath is very simple, and like the American Express card, we don't need to leave home without it. The problem is not practicing mindfulness. The problem is remembering to practice mindfulness. This is very difficult. Practicing over and over again, though, changes begin to occur. One of the current theoretical models of mindfulness now is that with our own thoughts, we create our own worlds. We create our own realities. Constructivist. An ancient Buddhist text called the Abhidhamma begins, "With our thoughts, we create the world." To understand the theory behind what may be changing, a metaphor can be useful. Let's start by assuming that we have many micro experiences, little tiny bits of experience moment by moment, and we'll call them moment duds. And there's internal moment duds and external moment duds. The internal moment duds are our thoughts and our feelings and body sensations moment by moment. The external moment duds are the situations and events, people and interactions that we find ourselves in. So we have all these moment duds constantly changing, constantly being created. Now, for very important evolutionary reasons, our minds develop to be good pattern detectors. So what we do is we connect the dots and we create pictures. Those of our ancestors who were best at creating cohesive pictures from limited information survived. Those who couldn't died, and they're out of the gene pool. So all human beings are very good at creating pictures from limited information. So let's imagine for the moment that reality is just this bunch of discrete moment dots arising moment by moment. This conglomerate of moment dots Jon Kabat-Zinn called the nowscape. Now, often in the nowscape, our external moment dots don't have enough information to create a cohesive picture. For example, to better understand a conversation we might be having with another person, we need to include our own thoughts and emotions and body sensations that are moment dots in the nowscape. Sometimes these internal moment dots relate a lot less to the external moment dots and more to our own history or baggage. These can include memories of the past or anticipations of the future. We can add our own learned beliefs, judgments, inferences, and often unrealistic expectations of the other person. We can add our hopes and desires and fears about the future. We create a shared nowscape using these internal processes. With selective attention, we can even add to or change or move around the dots a little bit until we create a picture that feels familiar, cohesive, satisfying. We're very efficient at connecting the moment dots. We're hardwired to detect patterns, even when no pattern exists. We use our own thoughts to fill in those unknowns. And then we connect the dots. We create realities that feel true and may look a lot like what we want or expect to see. The problem being, of course, is that all of those thoughts are creations of our own minds, events in the mind. So when we add all this in, our picture may not look much like reality. Remember that mindfulness is simply attention. Unbiased, non-judgmental, non-avoidant attention to one's present experiences. Mindful awareness can allow us to simply look at what's present and see more clearly what's there. In practicing mindfulness, a shift can occur in how we relate to our own internal experiences. In particular, we begin to see our own thoughts as just thoughts. Experiencing thoughts as events in the mind, accepting that the picture they create may not actually be accurate to reality. In other words, we stop buying into our own stories. We stop believing everything we think. We call this process decentering. And decentering provides a space to consider a greater variety of response choices and gives us opportunities to act with intention, compassion, and awareness. I'll talk about three programs briefly, just describing them. Some of you may be familiar. The first is mindfulness-based stress reduction. It was developed by Jon Kabat-Zinn in the late 1970s at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. Originally, MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, was developed for treatment of chronic, medically untreatable pain. It's since been translated into a lot of treatments for emotional pain as well as physical pain. MBSR is a structured 8-week class. It's a group program. There's generally 30 or more students in a class. 2.5-hour group sessions once a week, plus there's a 1 all-day practice session. And trained teachers offer guidance in 3 meditation practices: mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the body, which we call body scan, and mindful movement practices, which are just simple yoga postures. Enrolling in an MBSR class demands a big personal commitment because the program includes daily home practice of what's learned in class, 1 hour a day, 6 days a week. It's a big commitment. Now, MBSR was not developed by clinicians for clinical or psychiatric problems. A variant of that program is called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which was developed by clinicians for the purpose of treating recurrent episodic depression. MBSR is for community use. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is conducted by trained therapists, usually cognitive behavioral therapists. And because of that, the groups are smaller, and there's a lot more focus on using mindful awareness kind of as an early warning system to be able to detect early the approaching depression and take proactive behaviors to kind of head it off at the pass. We have very good treatments for depression, but depression is recurrent. For those who have had 2 or more episodes, the probability of relapse is over 90%. So MBCT was developed specifically for the prevention of depressive relapse. There's been a great deal of research on MBCT. It's now what's defined as an evidence-based psychotherapy. MBCT teaches individuals to work with the inevitable low moods by being more aware, by disengaging from the depressogenic thoughts before they spiral down. It teaches the patients to relate differently to those thoughts. But unlike cognitive therapy, there's no effort to actually change the thoughts. For those of you who are familiar with cognitive therapy, there's a process called cognitive restructuring where the thoughts are actually changed. This is more of a process of learning to accept that thoughts are just thoughts. Now, both MBSR and MBCT are programs for adults. And in my work as a clinical psychologist, I see a lot of suffering experienced by children, particularly children with depression and anxiety disorders. And for many children, those depressed or anxious thoughts can feel more real than whatever the actual experience is. My colleagues and I believe that children are better managed, better equipped to deal with their lives. They're very stressful lives these days, by cultivating mindfulness. So we've translated the adult mindfulness-based cognitive therapy into a developmentally appropriate, kid-friendly program. So MBCT for children is a 12-week program, and we work with children ages 8 to 12, or 3rd through 6th graders generally. The sessions are shorter. They're 90 minutes instead of 2.5 hours. And we keep the groups a lot smaller, generally no more than 6 to 8 children in a group. We teach these children that with awareness, they can choose how to respond to their own internal experiences rather than being pushed and pulled by their own thoughts and emotions. We use very short sensory-based activities to practice noting all of the things that capture our attention, and then practice returning attention to the present moment. So we have one session for mindfulness of touch, and another for mindful seeing, and another for mindful hearing, so forth. Now, if anyone's ever tried to make a 9-year-old sit still for 45 minutes, you'll understand why we shortened all the activities. In MBCT for children, most of the activities are 3 to 10 minutes. But with a lot of creative repetition, they're actually getting the same ideas. When we've taught these adaptive practices to children, we found that they were able to change how they relate to their own thoughts and feelings. Some of the children realize that what they infer is not necessarily true, what they fear is not necessarily real, and that thoughts are just thoughts. There are enormous benefits associated with mindfulness practice. Remember the discipline, it's an hour a day for training. Systematic mindfulness training can help us become more aware of our own thoughts and feelings and body sensations. We can develop a new way of relating to these internal experiences, specifically by learning mindful acknowledgement and acceptance of unwanted thoughts and feelings, develops a non-judgmental, non-avoidant relationship with our own experiences. So in a sense, mindfulness can be considered a form of exposure therapy. Repeated exposure to our own internal experiences can minimize how they're influencing our behaviors. We learn to turn toward the difficult thoughts rather than avoiding them. In the decentering process, we experience all thoughts as being just thoughts, even the thoughts that are telling us they're not. Decentering allows us to make conscious choices. We become free to choose proactive behaviors that can reduce our own emotional and cognitive suffering. So, in summary, cultivating mindful acceptance promotes psychological growth. We learn to experience the events of our lives, view our interactions with others, and understand the situations that we find ourselves in subtly different ways. The world may be perceived more kindly, with a heightened sense of curiosity and wonder and delight. We can become more attuned to our subjective worlds, that rich, ever-changing internal nowscape of thoughts and feelings and body sensations. Mindful awareness promotes acceptance of what is. The clarity of seeing brings the opportunity to make choices, seeing what choices we do have. Seeing those choices creates a freedom to live our lives with greater self-awareness, with greater intentionality, and greater compassion for ourselves and others. So by cultivating this particular form of attention, we may discover that mindfulness is not what we think. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your powerful words. This is very valuable to us. Dr. Semple will entertain a few questions after we have our offertory.
The comment there is that, in fact, working with children is fairly new, and there are several teams of researchers around the world. It's a very, very new field, but it is exploding quickly for that precise reason, which is that let's see if we can head off the problems before they occur. Let's stop the ambulance at the top of the cliff rather than at the bottom. So that's where my work is. I focus on typically the preteens, the 8 to 12s. But, for example, in San Jose, there's a program called Mindfulness-Based Cognitive Therapy for Teens, which is for 12 to 18-year-olds. So there is work being done. It's just very, very new. So the question is, if my book doesn't contain practices, will I recommend a book? First, the book does contain many, many practices. It is literally a step-by-step training manual to conduct the 12 sessions of MBCT for children. And there are sample dialogues, there are a multitude of different activities for children, and they're all described in detail. I would also recommend for parents, it's a wonderful book called The Mindful Child that was written by Susan Kaiser Greenflin, who's here in Los Angeles. And that's a lovely parenting book. My book is mostly intended for therapists to be able to conduct MBCTC, but I think parents will find it useful as well. Thank you. So the question is the therapy effective for oppositional defiant types, which is kind of a DSM jargon, diagnostic and statistical manual. Children who are resistant to adult authority and do that on an ongoing basis, it can be a big problem. It falls into the category of conduct disorders, and that can include things like malicious or damaging behavior, bullying activities, and so forth. Most of the work I've done has been on what's called the internalizing disorders, which is anxiety and depression. We have found some effectiveness with children with ODD and with conduct problems, and we've found some effectiveness with children with ADHD, attention deficit disorder. But our sample size with the conduct problems and ADHD aren't large enough yet to be able to really publish and extrapolate on that. We've seen some amazing changes in a couple of children who had some very severe oppositional problems, but that's more of clinical observations. The question is about the use of medications for children and how it fits in with the mindfulness programs. First disclaimer, I'm a clinical psychologist, not a psychiatrist. I don't have medical training. I do work at University of Southern California Medical School, so I interact with the medical profession, the psychiatrists, very frequently, every day, in fact. Personal opinion only is that medications are being overprescribed. That the therapies are very effective, both cognitive behavioral therapy and the mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for children, but they involve more time and effort on the part of the parents, the teachers, and so forth, and prescribing the pills is easier. That is a personal opinion. I disclaim all association with USC for that one. There's no contraindication to using medications with psychotherapy. And certainly for some of the more what's called severe and persistent childhood disorders, like bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, medications I believe are necessary because these are organic problems. You may be interested, I have ongoing research now translating MBCTC into a program we're calling Mindfulness Matters, which is a school-based program for teachers to implement pretty much the same interventions but in the classroom. And we're halfway through our study with that now, and hopefully we'll get good results and publish that manual as well. So the question is, are there mindful parenting workshops? The answer is yes. At UCLA, the Mindful Awareness Research Center, MARC, offers family and parenting workshops. Also on the west side, Santa Monica is Inside LA, that offers parenting classes. There's actually a program being developed in research called Mindfulness-Based Parenting. And the other center fairly close to here is UC San Diego Center for Mindfulness, where they're actually teaching the Mindfulness-Based Parenting program to parents. You can get online, get on their website, and enroll in a course. The question is about Marty Seligman's book on what's called positive psychology and remodeling behavior based on taking a positive approach. Mindfulness is not about change. It's about accepting what is there. And sometimes we can accept that we're just feeling really lousy or irritable or grouchy. Anybody ever wake up with the grouchies? Yeah. My concern about the positive psychology work that Marty is doing is that when I work with depressed patients particularly, they mind defaults to the negative, okay? Meaning that when they do wake up grouchy, the negative is, well, what's the matter with me? I can't even think positive anymore. Mindfulness is more in the line of just accepting what's there and making choices. When can we make a choice? We can only make a choice in this moment. We plan to make choices and then do something else, but moment by moment we're making choices. And the choice has to start from a full acceptance of what's actually happening, including whatever negativity happens to be present, and then going from there. So there really is not much overlap with Seligman's positive psychology with the mindfulness movement. Thank you very much.